We're on day two of the Oregon State Police. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5045. Mr. Superintendent, welcome. I believe that Bill was going to start out today. We've left it with Doug, kind of, and ran out of a little time. So, Bill, if you want to go ahead and start off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services, and we'll take you through today to the agency summary of the governor's budget. This will be, I think, the only budget you see in this subcommittee where we do a presentation for each of the divisions. This is an agency that is sufficiently complex and does so many different kinds of things that it wouldn't really be possible for us to do one single presentation for the whole agency. So today we'll just do the agency summary. Page 2 of my handout takes you through the numbers. The governor's budget is $166.9 million general fund, $391 million total fund, and that's about
a... Bill, let me just make sure that all members know that. That's the spiral walk. Doug?
Still short.
Do you have an extra one? Yeah.
Please.
Just open that thing up. Take it out.
Just don't want to get you in ahead of us. Very short,
that.
Bill.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
The general fund is about a 3% reduction from the fifth special session, about a 9% reduction from the close of session. Total funds is very similar to the fifth special session and about a percent and a half below the close of session. Page 3 shows you the different fund splits for the governor's budget. State Police's total budget is 43% general fund, about a percent lottery fund for fish and wildlife, 33% other funds, 18% federal funds, and a small amount of federal funds non-limited. Those are the counties. Page 4, summarizing what's happened first in the special sessions. There were elimination of 191 sworn officers in patrol, criminal, fish and wildlife, forensics, training, and administration. Elimination of 93 non-sworn forensic services positions, elimination of non-sworn positions in a variety of program units, 28 in dispatch, 22 in information systems, 47 in administration and business services, 6 in the LEDS program, 4 in training, 2 in emergency management, and 1 non-sworn in patrol. There were reductions in capital outlay that are used to purchase vehicles, buy forensics equipment, information equipment, very significant reductions there. The compensation increases, as with most agencies, were funded at 75% of what the 0103 costs would be. And finally, there was a fund shift to anticipated revenue from the sale of the remaining King Air twin-engine aircraft. Page 5 gives you a quick summary of the high level of the governor's budget. The special session reductions were continued in the 2003-05 session, as you saw, for all agencies. Although there were a restoration of, as you know, 40 patrol positions and 5 forensic scientists to continue the operation of the Bend Lab. These, again, are the governor's budget. there is funding to open a new forensics laboratory and medical examiner's office in Clackamas. There's a key health and safety issue in the existing facility, so we do have money to open the facility that's already been purchased and is about to go through remodeling. There's a reorganization, a pretty significant reorganization of divisions and programs that we'll talk to you about as we go through the budget. There are backfill of some reductions in other funds and federal funds in the Criminal Investigations Division, the Fire Marshal's Office, and the Fish and Wildlife Division. There are some increased fees in the Fire Marshal Division with enabling legislation as necessary to approve those fees. There are some reclassifications and establishment of positions for double fills that we funded with existing revenue, so they wouldn't increase the dollar number. We just take care of the position issues. And finally, there's increased revenues that support the 9/11 program based on the existing tax structure. Page 6 just reminds you of what you did in Senate Bill 5548, in case you could have possibly forgotten in a week since then. But you restored 40 troopers for $391,000. Those 40 were included in the governor's budget, so there will be no 03-05 roll-up. You restored 40 forensics positions for $561,000, roughly. 5 of those were restored in the governor's position, 35 were not. The roll-up cost for those 35 would be about $4.5 million general fund in the 03-05 biennium. And you restored five detectives for tobacco enforcement with about $87,000 of other funds. These are also not included in the governor's budget. To continue them in the next biennium would be about $787,000 other funds in five positions. Okay. On page 7, I want to give you a heads up for an issue that we may be, hopefully we won't have to bring back to you, but we may have to bring back to you. And the January Emergency Board approved about $500,000 for in other funds to reimburse the state and local firefighting programs to fight the Arley fire that started on the Warm Spring Reservation and moved off it fairly quickly. When we were before you in January, before E-Board in January, we believed that the Bureau of Indian Affairs would reimburse us for that $500,000. We have heard from their regional staff that they will not do so. We are continuing to discuss that with them through the governor's office. If we are unable to get them to agree to cover the cost of those fires, we will be back to you with a request for $500,000 to cover those costs for this biennium. So that's a heads up of an issue that we hopefully won't bring back to you, but we wanted to let you know if it does come back. Okay, page 8, we'll start looking at some of the graphics on the department. The first shows you the general fund budget. Patrol makes up about 45% of this agency's general fund budget. Human resources, which includes the administration command control of the department, the dispatch centers, the business functions, is about 21%. Criminal division is 14%. Forensics, with the reductions, is down to about 8%. And then the other divisions go down in like fashions. Page 9 shows you the breakout of the $391 million total fund budget. Total funds patrol is now 22%. Emergency management now is 25%, with the 9/11 revenues that are distributed to local governments for operation of the 9/11 system, and with money from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to do various disaster planning, preparedness, and recovery. Criminal Justice Services, which manages federal grants in the law enforcement, criminal justice, some human services area, is about 14% of the other funds budget. And then the other divisions are run down from about 9% on down to the smallest divisions at 1 2%. Page 10 shows you where the dollars are spent in categories. In the general fund budget, 72% of those general fund dollars are for personal services. They're for people, salaries of the officers and non-sworn folks who manage the department. 25% is for services supplies. There is a very small amount for capital outlay. The general fund capital outlay budget is reduced by half since the close of session, which creates a significant problem for the department in terms of managing its information systems and forensics units over time, and we'll be talking to you about that as we go through the next week and a half. Debt service, 1% for equipment for the new emergency coordination facility that opened on State and Hawthorne here in Salem, and a very tiny amount for special payments. Looks very different on page 11 for the total funds budget. Now personal services are 44% of that $391 million. Special payments make up 36% now, and that is, again, the 9/11 payments to cities and counties. It's the FEMA money that goes out the door to local governments, and it's the Criminal Justice Services Division federal grants that go to various law enforcement and criminal justice agencies. Services supply 17%, capital outlay 3%, and, again, a small amount for debt service. Starting on page 12, then, we'll walk you through the development of the governor's budget, starting with the 2001-03 legislative, the adopted budget of $183 million general fund and $397 million total fund. The emergency board actions through April, there was just a small number of them, $700,000 general fund and about $4 million total fund. That was a tobacco enforcement tax force dollars, federal high-intensity drug trafficking area funds to enhance that program, and about $100,000 in the National Marine Fisheries Services grants to provide equipment for the Fish and Wildlife Division. Special Session 2 reduced the budget by $7.2 million general fund, a small increase in lottery funds and federal funds. The primary actions in that second special session were to eliminate the January 2003 recruit school, which also eliminated 41 sworn positions. Three other sworns and 31 non-sworns were eliminated as part of the actions in that special session. You did restore three fish and wildlife positions with lottery dollars. and service and supplies and capital outlays were reduced. The sale of the remaining King Air was authorized, and there were a variety of administrative reductions as well. Moving forward in development of the governor's budget, the base budget adjustments, as you've seen, the roll-up of 2001-03 position actions, compensation changes, increased the general fund budget by $11.6 million, total funds budget by $17.4 million, eliminated five positions and 33.92 FTE. Those are primarily the FTE that were eliminated in the second special session that then phase out as we develop the next budget. The estimated cost of 2003-05 step increases were $2.6 million general fund, $3.6 million total funds. As you know, we'll be working with you and with your legislative fiscal staff to strip those merit increases out of the budget as we move forward. There's a small debt service increase on the COPs that were sold for the emergency coordination facility of about $79,000 general fund. Okay. Essential packages, a vacancy savings of about $1.7 million increase, $2.3 million total funds. Phase-in and phase-out one-time expenditures increased the general fund by about $870,000 general fund and reduced total funds by $8.3 million and eliminated one position. Actions here were restoration of the one-time reductions in phase-out from the special sessions as opposed to the permanent reductions. Phases of rent costs at the emergency coordination facility in Salem, and the phase out of a variety of primarily other and federal funded programs, alleged message switch reengineering, the public safety data warehouse project that was canceled over the interim, and one-time COP revenues that were used to purchase equipment for the emergency coordination facility. Package 30 on page 14, inflation state government service charges. Inflation, $1.3 million general fund, $2.2 million total fund. State government service charges increased by $7.6 million general fund, $8.4 million total funds. And that very large increase is primarily due to increased tort liability assessments from Task Force Management Division. You've talked about, I think, all the generic drivers of the increases in insurance, the workers' comp being charged for the first time in 10 years, property assessments going up, tort liability cases in general going up. In addition, there was one very large use of force case that affected this agency that was a significant driver to why you're seeing the tort costs go up so significantly for state police.
Mr. Chair, I think when we do the DA's budget, which also I think some members have mentioned has a large tort liability increase in it, that we'll ask someone from risk management to come over and talk about that one and probably this one too, because this is very large also, just to make sure everyone has a good understanding, maybe 10-minute discussion around that issue. Because there are, I mean, Representative Hansen, I think, yesterday asked what was the increases given all the cuts in this budget, and it was mainly personnel, and I had forgotten to mention this large tort liability increase also.
And that is a result of a settled claim?
That was it was a lawsuit. Yeah.
Okay. And I assume that you'll get into it, but you're down to the technical adjustments now. Is there some proposed adjustment relative to the price of fuel for the cruisers that we get out on the road?
Mr. Chair, we have not addressed that issue at this point. On a statewide basis, we haven't looked into that.
It doesn't affect you?
Clearly it would. I think that would be an issue that we need to look at some more. We'll need to see whether this is a short-term jump in fuel taxes that will drop again if the impending war were to be successful, as I believe happened 10 years ago. If it's not, we'll either have to come back and talk to you about it again, or we'll have to talk to the departments, not only this department, but our department and others as well, as how those costs will be absorbed. But it's not something that we had addressed when the governor's budget was put together, as it was not that kind of an issue at that time. But yes, you're right, it's a good issue as we go forward.
Before we get to that particular point, with the amount of patrol, 45% of the general fund involved in patrol, it looks to me like that's going to be an issue that we're going to have to certainly address before we get through the June 30 implementation of a new budget. Thank you.
Finally, the technical adjustments here, primarily the transfer among divisions, and you'll see some of the ones that in this package that don't really have policy implications. You'll see some of the other reorganization issues that have some more policy concerns that will be shown in policy packages. But this is just transfer the dispatch centers from Information Management Division to Human Resources Division, supervision of the SWAT and the mobile response teams from the Human Resources Division to the Patrol Services Division, and a transfer of the Identification Services section that does background checks, et cetera, from Forensic Services to Information Management. So it's a reorganization to improve how the department operates. Package 70, revenue reductions. There really are quite a number here, $9.9 million in total funds and elimination of 36 positions, really from a variety of different revenue issues. There's a shortfall in the transfers from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Marine Board, Department of Human Services, Oregon State University, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. In addition, there are reduced revenues from ballot measure 66 lottery funds, the fire insurance premium tax, the criminal fines and assessment account, fees on card lock users, and the tax on pay-per-view boxing and wrestling events, which was parenthetically eliminated by the courts. Some of these reductions you'll see as we go through the policy package are restored. Others just simply remain the elimination of positions and functions in some cases.
I'm sorry. Senator George, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reduction in Measure 66 lottery funds. And my understanding is those numbers are up.
Well, it's a flow at different points of the budget. When this package was put together, there was a reduction. You'll see later. We'll see some. So it's just the technicalities of the way we put the budgets together sometimes.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask a question of the superintendent and maybe of staff also. Not so much in terms of the details of the major tort liability claim, but in terms of how it was treated by DAS. In terms of setting their rates, do we know if it's treated like the... I would assume it's not an everyday occurrence. Was it treated like a unique occurrence, or is it like a permanent adjustment to the rates that you...
Ms. Chair, Senator, if I could, we amortize those over several biennial period, so it's not a permanent hit. It'll come back down again over time.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please follow up.
So in essence, they are basically paying back the judgment and the claim. Over those number
over
of
time.
Years.
Yeah, there are other issues that are driving, when you see risk in front of you, you'll see there are other issues that are driving the tort costs up, but this particular cost will be charged over a period of time rather than a single hit in one biennium.
Thank you. Please proceed, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Package 81 has third special session actions, which reduced this budget by $3 million general fund, a little bit of other funds and federal funds, and eliminated 9 positions. Cost of living increases for employees salary range 38 and above were eliminated here. There were 7 sworn managers that were eliminated. The Coos Bay Forensics Laboratory was closed at this time. There were further reductions in service supplies and capital outlays and a variety of one-time administrative reductions as well. Package 82 shows the fifth special section, House Bill 5100, Section 1 reductions. Those are the reductions that were actually specified. And there were $880,000 of general fund reductions there. Those were service and supplies, capital outlay reductions, and some vacancies and fund shifts as well that were moved to other funds. Package 83 contains actions of the October 2002 Emergency Board. This reflects the 2003-05 roll-up of the department's rebalance that was brought forward to the Emergency Board in October and has a net impact agency-wide of about $3.2 million general fund in one position. Those actions shifted the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to general fund after the pay-per-view revenues were no longer available as a result of court action. It funds shortages in the medical examiner's budget for toxicology services and forensics pathology services, and shifted vacancy and other savings into traditionally underfunded service and supply accounts such as vehicle operations, data processing, and attorney general costs. And the net impact of that, as I said, was $3.2 million general fund. Package 90 is a program reduction of about $516,000 general fund. There was a state general fund match on the LEDS message switch reengineering project, a technology project, that it was no longer needed after that project was completed. So we've phased up that general fund amount. Package 91 is the fifth special session, House Bill 5100, Section 2 reductions. Those are the unspecified reductions, the larger amount. And the roll-up of those was $42.3 million general fund, a small reduction in federal funds, the elimination of 321 positions and 319.5 FTE. Those reductions eliminated 101 troopers, 4 special unit supervisors and a research position in patrol, eliminated 25 detectives, 6 fish and wildlife officers, 99 forensics positions, resulted in planning for the closure of the Pendleton, Ontario, and Bend forensics labs, eliminated 12 dispatch and 22 information systems positions, 6 LES positions, and 46 management training and business services positions. And the roll-up of that, again, was $42.3 million general fund. Package 92 contains the restorations in the governor's budget, the 40 patrol officers, and the 5 forensics positions to continue the Bend Lab operation, and that was $6.4 million general fund and 45 positions, 45 FTE. Now, that takes you through kind of the standard packages. There are 32 additional individual policy packages that occur through the divisions, and I'll summarize those at this time, and then as we go through the presentations for each division, we'll give you the detail on those as we go forward. Those 32 packages increased general fund by about $1.5 million, by about $18 million in total funds, and established 31 positions. They fund rent, equipment costs, and debt service for the new forensics laboratory medical examiner's office in Clackamas that will be remodeled and opened during the biennium. It will restore some of the positions that were eliminated due to problems with other funds revenues in the arson investigations fire marshals unit, with the legislative concept to modify the fire insurance premium tax and increase in fee revenues. It also will shift divisions and programs. Here are some additional parts of the organization that really have more policy implications, and so we presented those to you here rather than the central packages. The training division is eliminated as a separate unit, and it's transferred to the Human Resources Division. Capitol Mall, Legislative Security, and Dignitary Protection are transferred to the Criminal Investigations Division, and the LEDS Division is eliminated as a separate unit and transferred to the Office of Information and Management. And finally, there's an increase of 9/11 expenditure limitation to reflect what the actual revenues will be. Other issues in these 32 packages will be an increase in funding for hazardous material programs in the Fire Marshals Division, some fund shifts from temporary appointments to salaries and benefits to establish 21 limited duration part-time sworn positions for temporary patrol, fish and wildlife, criminal, and training assignments. Essentially, we're moving dollars to where they really are being spent over time rather than putting them where they had resided previously. We were classifying 13 positions, establishing position for 9 double fills, and replacing expired or insufficient revenue to continue 22 positions on a full-time basis with no additional general fund. Primarily, this is due to shifting service and supplies amounts into personal services in order to pay for the position actions.
I just have one question relative to on package 32 regarding the shifting. The shifting of temporary appointments, salaries, benefits to establish where the actual sworn positions are at in the various locations. Some of those are assigned to Dignitary Protection Unit. Are they appropriately accounted for in their proper spots, Bill?
They are.
Okay, thank you.
Just a clarification. This is not package 32. This is a summary of 32 different packages.
I'm sorry. I
wasn't sure I was clear there. So.
Okay.
Okay. A few fee and revenue changes. House Bill 2248 increases the liquid petroleum gas fees to support the state fire marshal program. House Bill 2249 establishes fees for inspection of various residential facilities and establishes fees for underground storage tanks. House Bill 5046 ratifies various state fire marshal fees that were increased administratively and now come back to you to be ratified according to the statutory process. And finally, there's a legislative concept being developed to remedy the fire insurance premium tax shortfall. And if I may, I'm going to take a few minutes to focus on this issue because you will see it in this budget, you'll see it in the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training budget, and it's fairly complicated and unusual for a public safety issue, so I wanted to take a couple extra minutes and explain it to you a little bit. The background goes to the way the state has structured dealing with bankruptcies for property and casualty insurance companies. The Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association is established in statute and levies an assessment on insurance companies that operate in the state to cover the property and casualty claims that would be normally charged against companies that have since gone bankrupt. The insurance companies that are assessed through this process are allowed to offset the assessments that they pay against their corporate excise tax, their corporate income tax. And those assessments are allowed at 20% of the assessments per year on a five-year basis on a use it or lose it arrangement. Either you don't have enough corporate income tax, you can't use the full 20%. Where this involves the public safety budgets is there is a backup to that offset against the corporate income tax, where if they can't offset that 20% in a given year against the income tax, corporate income tax, they can offset it against the fire insurance premium tax that funds the state fire marshal, it funds the Department of State Police arson investigation units, and funds the fire training and standards program for DPSST. Now, OIGA has assessed approximately $30 million in assessments in 2001-2002, and additional large assessments are expected for the next several years. Now, as you probably are not surprised, given the economic climate we're in, given the impact on September 11th on insurance companies, we're not going to see these companies with much net income to be able to be paying corporate taxes against. As a result, the expectation is that most of the assessments will occur against the fire insurance premium tax. To give you a notion of what the dollars are here, because of this insurance structure in the state, the insurance division is projecting $3.7 million from the fire insurance premium tax to support the three public safety programs. If we didn't have these insurance guarantee association offsets, they'd be projecting a normal level of revenue of about $11.8 million. So it's a very, very significant reduction in the revenue source that supports these three programs. And the revenue forecast in March 2003 that just came out showed a further reduction to $3.3 million. And because of the nature of the data that's available, both Legislative Fiscal and BAM have looked at that, we think this $3.3 million is still significantly too high. We think that, in fact, the programs are going to see a lot less in revenue. As I said, these are programs to support the fire marshal, the arson investigation unit you'll hear today, and the fire programs from DPSST you'll be hearing in a few weeks. So there are a couple of legislative concepts that are being considered that would eliminate the offsets of the Insurance Guarantee Association assessments against the premium tax. The first would remove the five-year limit on offsets against the corporate income tax so that the companies could hold them until they could use them when they had enough income tax to pay it off, whether that's 5 years, whether that's 10 years, whether that's however that is. What that in essence says, it's leaving the general fund to cover the cost of claims against bankrupt insurance companies. The other alternative that's being reviewed and discussed is to allow the insurance companies to establish a premium surcharge to recover their assessments in that manner, and that would essentially pass the cost along to the policyholders. So those are the ideas that have been developed through various work groups in the interim. Both of those concepts, I think one has dropped, the other should drop fairly soon. The governor's office is reviewing, hasn't made a recommendation as to which way they will suggest you go, but you will see that moving forward. So the governor's budget between the three programs has $8.5 million in revenues from the fire insurance premium tax. Of that amount, $5.4 million is dependent upon some kind of a legislative fix to this problem. So there's an extended version of a complicated problem that you will be seeing in a couple of different times.
So the magnitude of the deficiency for the Oregon Insurance Guarantee is actually known. I mean, the losses there are known at this point.
Mr. Chair, they are not actually. This is not to recover the assets of the bankrupt companies. It's to cover the claims against those companies, and sometimes those aren't fully known for some significant number of years. So we expect there will be additional assessments coming out in the next several years, maybe $5 to $10 million a year for a year or two more, maybe a lesser amount that for some years beyond that. We are still, I understand, still paying some claims from the 70s and 80s. They're still wrapping up a small amount there. So we expect this will be, if the problem recovers pretty quickly and the insurance company goes back to normal, we expect this will be a revenue problem probably through the remainder of this decade, just even if it doesn't get any worse.
Okay. So. Keep in mind, Mr. Chair, one other reason insurance companies are having trouble is they depend so much on investment income, and those rates of return are much lower now because of the economics. So it's not only the increased claims it's also increased problems in their investment side.
Reduced revenues.
Right.
In effect. I guess I was concerned about this because it starts with the premise that that at some point we're going to get over the deficiency in the insurance guarantee account. In fact, that could be a long-term program, particularly when you're looking at the 20% obligation per annum. Use it or lose it against your tax liability. One of the tax liabilities would be based upon, number one, how well are you doing in the actual insurance industry after 9/11, and number two, you know, how well you're doing in your investment portfolio in the current triple and possibly quadruple dip in the market. So.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And the legislative proposals we're looking at would solve that problem in terms of the fire programs in the public safety area. It wouldn't necessarily solve it in terms of either the general fund, depending on if you go one way, or the impact on the policyholders if you go the other way. So you're right, it's a long-term concern.
Thank you.
Wrapping up quickly, we have some technical adjustments. Page 23 just gives a list of them. A lot of these really are pretty technical. The impact would reduce the general fund budget by about $237,000, the total funds by about $620,000, and establish a position 7.74 FTE. The hodgepodge of different things here. There were two positions that were abolished in special session two that we were asking to restore with other funds and federal funds. There's excess other funds limitation in the patrol division from Department of Transportation grants and contracts that there's no revenue support, so we just need to get the empty limitation out of the budget. There were some services supplies that were shifted to personal services, anticipation of some reclassifications for positions that were since abolished, so that shift doesn't need to occur. Four positions were just eliminated in error as we prepared the government's budget, so we'd like to resolve that. There are a number of cases where we had estimates of what personal services impacts would be of different reductions that were just wrong when we finally loaded the numbers into the budget system. We'd like to clean that up as well. There was a position number on a reclassification that we listed incorrectly, and we'd like to clean that up again so we reclass the appropriate position and not an inappropriate position. We have a small amount of shift of services supplies to state government service charges to eliminate a negative balance we had in one program unit through an error. And there's a couple of shifts between packages that need to occur just because of the technicalities of how positions are carried in our system. So it's all, I think it's pretty technical. But again, the impact is about a reduction of $237,000 general fund, about $620,000 total funds. And that is my presentation for the agency.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, we at this time, my presentation is concluded. We would like to move on to the patrol division. Stand to the chair and ask Captain Hayes, the division director, to come forward and present to the committee.
Thank you. I apologize for being gone. I had to meet with the co-chairs. So.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Captain Chuck Hayes, the director of our Patrol Services Division, which is part of our Central Operations Command Bureau within the Department of State Police. We have seven full-time staff employees that are assigned to General Headquarters who coordinate and manage the division programs and work directly with the field, where we have about 329 full-time officers assigned to various locations throughout the state. We've provided you with an organizational chart of the division that should be there in your handout. I will not take the time to go through that.
Maybe we better just find it to make sure that we've got it here, Captain Hayes.
Hopefully it is at the back of your handout.
Let's see.
Very back.
Yeah, very back on the patrol. Total full-time FTE 0305, 350.67.
That's correct, sir.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
The Patrol Services Division provides uniform presence in law enforcement services throughout the state. We have primary responsibility for crash reduction, crime reduction, and other transportation safety issues. That includes responding to emergency calls for service on rural, state, and interstate highways. Our uniformed troopers are providing patrol coverage over 7,000 miles of state and interstate highways and are providing a direct association to the voluntary compliance of traffic laws and deterrence to criminal activity. We also augment and support local law enforcement in accordance with cooperative policing agreements to help meet the needs of the public and for criminal investigations and transportation safety. Our division members are also involved, obviously, in enforcing the motor vehicle code laws, but also in motor carrier regulations. We also enforce the criminal laws, criminal code. We also enforce fish and wildlife regulations. Our members also conduct criminal investigations and also conduct crash investigation and analysis. We conduct drug driver impairment recognition. We provide motorist assists. In fact, last year we conducted over 33,000 motorist assists statewide. We provide medical assistance on state and interstate highways. Last year, doing over 700 medical assists. We investigate domestic disturbances, and we also provide with it from the division the primary pool of personnel for our SWAT and mobile response teams. And what I'd like to do with the chair's permission is bring up Captain Tim McLean of our Special Operations Command. If he could come forward and possibly give you a short overview of the SWAT and the MRT operations.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim McLean.
Start over. Apologize. For the record, I'm Tim McLean, the Department of State Police. I currently have the privilege of supervising the dedicated men and women of the Special Operations Division. Special Operations consists of the Special Weapons and Tactics Team, our Mobile Response Team, and also our Command Centers. Command Centers were previously referred to as our Dispatch Centers. If all goes well, I'll be back before you next week to talk further about the Command Centers. Today, as Captain Hage has said, I'd just like to spend a little bit of time talking about the SWAT and MRT team. As Captain Hage said, the troopers that volunteer for those two teams primarily come from the patrol division, so we thought it would be a good time to kind of give you an overview of those. The Oregon State Police Special Weapons and Tactics Team was formed back in 1988. The reason for it was after a search warrant that was served down in Jackson County. Mr. Chair, you'd remember that one, where we unfortunately had two officers shot and one suspect killed. The state police decided at that time it was best to form a special weapons team. Since that time, we've served over 388 either high-risk search warrants or responded to barricaded subjects since that time. The team is comprised of one team commander, one assistant team commander, and at this time we have 21 tactical officers and four crisis negotiators. Those troopers assigned to this team are stationed primarily on the I-5 corridor, with the exception we have two troopers assigned out of the Pendleton office. During a response, whether it's a critical incident that's happening right now, would determine how many troopers we'd probably call into the situation. If it's something that's happened here, for instance, in the Linn County area, we may not bring the troopers over from Pendleton or the trooper up from Medford to respond to that area.
I have a question, if I may.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Tim, yesterday we had Chief of Police from Portland, Mark Croker, here, and they have a SWAT team as well. It's a tactical unit team of some sort, whether it's special weapons or I don't really know. One of the questions that I asked was, under what circumstances do those folks employ their teams and cross-employ? I guess the concern that I had was I just wanted to make sure that, Chief Croker did give me some satisfaction that, in fact, they didn't just go out and employ their team wherever they felt like they were needed anywhere in the state. I guess my concern is the OSP SWAT team basically is directed from somewhere in Salem, I assume, somewhere here on this side of the state, and you kind of assess from this side of the state whether it's needed in conjunction with some of your own staff on the other sides of the state or in other places. The concern I've got is that shouldn't local office or shouldn't local police agencies be involved in the decision before SWAT teams are flown out long distances across the state? Wouldn't it be more appropriate to have local folks? I mean, there was a case in Malheur County where a fellow had gone off his meds and started shooting around his cabin in the mountains, and we had a full-scale SWAT team in there. And my concern is that you know, this, it wasn't like the first time it had ever happened. And I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars and man hours and so forth may have been involved in getting, you know, flying the teams out there and spending the time that was necessary to do that. But, you know, it's something that our folks handle for nothing. I mean, not for nothing, literally. It takes them away from their other jobs in the local county responsibilities. But shouldn't there be some kind of a some kind of an invitation or some kind of an operation that would include the local police agencies and police forces before you deploy probably a dozen or more folks from this side of the state? And now you won't have now you won't have two King Air to fly across the state when you need to start moving people and material and so forth around. Is I would certainly hope that before you go before the state police SWAT team goes to start to rent an Air Force to drive your folks around the state, that you'd please coordinate with the local law enforcement officers. Would that be asking too much, or what's where are we missing? Where are we missing the link of communication there? I need to know that.
Mr. Chair, Representing Butler. To answer your question, I guess I could look back at the last biennium, or this biennium, excuse me. We've had 77 call-outs. 14 of those were requests within the Oregon State Police. And by that, the Oregon State Police was the primary agency that responded to that call, and they called us, or they were the primary agency in that investigation, such as a narcotics investigation. Those other calls, and I have a breakdown here I could provide for you later, were a request from other agencies, whether it be a sheriff's office or a local police department. And normally those requests would either come straight through to our SWAT commander, myself, or into our dispatch. One thing we don't do, when a miscible agency or sheriff's office calls our SWAT team, we don't spend a lot of time asking questions. If they've gotten to the point that they need us, we're normally rolling their direction. So I don't know if that answers the question, but we...
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, it really doesn't answer the question, because I think it, other than maybe what happens is that the first responder on the call may have been an OSP and said, looks like somebody's trying to shoot their way out of the cabin. No one was in imminent danger at that particular point, but unfortunately, rather than contact the local policing agency, in this case a sheriff, it was a remote area, rather than contact the sheriff, evidently the folks were contacted over here, and then before we knew it, you know, that we've got the airplane swarming in with the folks. And I appreciate the great job that was done, but when it's at what cost to the state of Oregon, at what cost to the peace of the community? And I guess I would just hope that there would be a little more coordination with the local policing, rather than have it all as an OSP response without really understanding the local situation. And then also recognize that many times within sheriff's agencies and these local policing offices, those folks are locally elected and they're locally homegrown normally, and are responsive to the local citizens. And they might know the situation a little bit better than someone that's gotten out of the academy on this side of the state and just happened to be hired into an office on the other side of the state. So I am very concerned about the continued funding of a SWAT organization that basically has an attitude that we really don't care about what you think you need locally. Now, if excuse me, if in fact it was an issue where you as a result of drug interdiction and you had a good-sized bus that you knew was coming down maybe my local sheriffs in rural Oregon didn't know or didn't understand or didn't appreciate what was going down, God bless you. Come and do it and take care of them and get rid of the bad guys. My concern is that when you got somebody that's just off their meds and an OSP is the first responder and the only responder, and then we've got a SWAT team swarming into these rural counties, it really doesn't. And the local folks look at that and they say, wait a minute, that isn't a good use of our funds, and it makes it very difficult for us to make a budget decision that would say, yeah, put a lot more money into this, this is a good thing for us to do, when my constituents look at it and say, man, those guys are wasting money by the bucketfuls.
Captain Clint, can you maybe look at the incident and get back to Representative Butler and the committee as to maybe the specific circumstances surrounding this particular situation? Could be that the radios were not interoperable and they couldn't talk to each other. But
Mr. Chair.
That's another issue.
Just a quick clarification. Earlier, you had said there had been 388 responses since the SWAT team was formed in 88.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's okay. Correct. Yes, sir.
And then in your response. In the last year, there were 77. Are those different kinds of 77 call-outs? Are those? I guess what I'm wondering is, are the 77 the same thing as the 388 incident reports?
They're included. The 77 refer to this biennium, which would be 2001 to 2003.
Okay, for the biennium.
77 with the last one being yesterday, which was a request to Hermiston for a search warrant.
The sheriff's objective. Okay. Thanks, Tim.
Next team is the Oregon State Police Mobile Response Team. It was formed in 1991. This team is basically trained to handle large crowd events. We currently have 39 troopers assigned to this team, along with four supervisors. The teams are broken up into squads. 13 troopers, one supervisor. The team is, again, comprised mainly of patrol division. There's 36 members on that team that are patrol division. The other members are from the Fish and Wildlife Division and the Criminal Division. The team members are assigned, unlike SWAT, where mainly I said they're on the I-5 corridor, the team members on this one are assigned throughout the state. They are ready for deployment to any event that we may get a request. Some events we handle on a regular basis, which would be the seaside break, the state fair, we take care of that. Other incidents that we may be called in, again, a request mainly from another agency would be civil disturbance, a natural disaster, maybe a flood. We may come in and help out or assist with traffic. The team members on this one are cross-trained in a number of disciplines, including drug recognition, defense tactics, chemical agents, police bicycle operation, and also the majority of the team members are trained to respond to weapons of mass destruction. The team, I'm proud to say, is recognized as one of the leading crowd control teams in the state, and they have trained several other agencies, Portland, Eugene, Medford, Salem, to name a few. Just a point of clarification on this one kind of versus SWAT. Mobile response team assignment. This past year I've had an assignment where I have requested as few as four troopers for that assignment, to one incident where I requested all available troopers respond. But normally we certain events we can handle with one squad, which would be 11, and a supervisor. That's all I have for the overview.
Good explanation yesterday for both those too. So thanks, Tim, for button that up and knowing the number of incidences that you had to deploy those teams throughout the state. That's very, very helpful. Other questions for the captain? Nice to see you.
Thank you, Captain.
Mr. Chair, I'll continue on. And I'm on page 2 of your handout, which outlines our statutory authority, which is contained in chapters 146, 166, 181, 237, 276, 418, 461, 475, and 813 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, and we also have Administrative Rule 257. Delivery of services is also outlined on page 2 of your handout, and the division delivers services through two primary strategies that have been adopted by the state police, and that is performance excellence and customer satisfaction. Crime reduction and also crash reduction on rural and state, rural state and interstate highways are two strategic goals that have been adopted by the division. And to carry these out, we have some primary enforcement programs that I'll go through just rather quickly. In the area of crash reduction, it's high visibility, hazardous traffic violation enforcement, impaired driving enforcement, commercial vehicle enforcement, occupant protection education enforcement, and highway work zone enforcement. The two areas within crime reduction are criminal apprehension through patrol enforcement and juvenile crime education and enforcement. To maximize our efforts in these areas, we have five priority support programs that also enhance and improve the enforcement and delivery of these services. I'll touch on these as well. The support programs include our aircraft patrol, collision reconstruction, drug evaluation classification, the motorcycle patrol, and non-preference tow program that we have.
Mr. Chairman, before we get away from this, I think there's anything that I've witnessed and had more comments by constituents about is the amount of time, particularly if they've lived in other states, that we spend on collision reconstruction, in other words, particularly at the case where the accident occurs. We seem to tie up the roads longer based on what these people told me than other jurisdictions they've been into. Do you have an explanation of that? Because I personally think I've witnessed a longer period of time to get the road cleared.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I can't address that. Our 14 crash reconstruction experts that we have, and we have 22 technical folks as well, they're trained actually to get that highway open as fast as we can. Sometimes that is beyond our authority, though. There may be other issues that are involved. So our officers are actually trained to mark that highway. They know how to mark it. They can go back and reconstruct that crash if they do a good job of marking those vehicles. So I would have to say, from our standpoint, I believe our people are doing a very good job in getting those highways open, because that's something we are concerned about as well. Because every time we have to close a highway for a long period of time, it's costing literally thousands and thousands of dollars. So we work very closely with ODOT to ensure that we can get those highways opened on state and interstate highways. Now, there are some circumstances that may prohibit us from doing that right away. And naturally, if there's numerous deaths that are involved, well, then sometimes we're waiting on the medical response. We're also on the coroner, things like that. So those are things that always could be affected.
Well, I mean, is there any way to measure that? No, because one person commented in Europe that literally if there is a crash, the response comes in, they photograph that thing, you know, probably video cameras. And immediately this, you know, with all that data in mind and probably some measuring technologies, boom, that thing's measured out, moved off the road, and that highway's reopened. And I'm really concerned. I mean, are we comparing ourselves with the amount of time for a given accident with other states to get that road back open again? Because what I've noticed, I'm sure you guys have seen it, whenever you have any obstruction of traffic and now you have cars backing up, then what you start getting is those little collisions that have where the guy rear ends the guy in front of him, and you know, vans in front, he didn't see the guy hit the brakes, that typical type of thing. And because I've, you know, like I say, a real concern about the idea of making sure that we expedite getting that road back open, because we don't have alternatives in Oregon. We can't redirect to another highway. We don't have any.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I agree 100%. In fact, you talked a little bit about technology in Europe. Well, we are also exploring that technology and getting more of that measuring equipment that we can do. And we, as our funds allow us, and we're purchasing some of that through federal funds, we're getting this type of equipment now and instruments that will allow us to do that. So as technology improves and as we get that equipment, then you do have that availability to you. And you're right, because there are some areas, take Interstate 5 as an example, having worked 8 years in Albany, there are certain portions of I-5 when you have a crash there, there is no place to reroute traffic. We are kind of hurting in that area. So you're right, when we do have a situation like that, it's imperative that we get the highway opened up as fast as we can. And so we are working to do that, and I think we're making some improvements.
Captain Hayes, is part of the problem, though, that you really do have to pull out your expert people and pull them back out to the field? You don't, I mean, now because of the troop restraint, you don't have the availability of having people on the road to go out and do these reconstruction. I mean, is that a problem for the department?
I would agree, Mr. Chair, that it is. We have some technical folks, and they are positioned in various locations. In fact, you'll have a chance to hear from one of those, that Senior Trooper Pierce from the Astoria office, who is one of our collision reconstruction experts, and he's a very busy trooper, and unfortunately he has a number of counties that he's kind of taking care of when it comes to some of these technical major crashes that he is investigating. And so it's a problem. We don't have a lot of these troopers, and so they're spread pretty thin. We have one that works out of the Ontario office that is basically in charge of all of Eastern Oregon from Bend East, that has to take care of that area for some of those major fatalities.
Okay.
Captain, what's the training cost to train a, what's the additional training cost to train a trooper, kind of to have the accent reconstruction?
I wish I could tell you. I have my expert here with Lieutenant Miller, but I can get that answer
well,
for you.
Lieutenant Miller, when he comes to testify, or your trooper comes
we
to
can
testify,
get
maybe we can talk a little bit about
right.
that, if possible, or how many additional hours of training yeah. or whatever.
I will do that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, what's the criteria? When do you require or when do you do a major reconstruction? What's the criteria? Is it involves a fatality or criminality or what's the...
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, the majority of the time it is a fatality or it's some major crash that possibility of some legal civil action could be there as well. We have the majority of our technical crash investigation center around fatalities where there is criminal charges that it looks like could occur. If it's just a one car run off the road or smash into a tree, you're not normally going to see a reconstruction expert come out for that. Our troopers are trained to handle those kind. But when we have multiple fatalities, it looks like there could be a civil action or a huge lawsuit. Also, when there's a possibility that it could be a defect in the highway, then ODOT. We have to protect their interests in this as well because those have been some of the issues before where, again, it's all comes back where they're trying to come back civilly on the state. So we are involved in those type of investigations as well.
Have there been any discussions in terms, you know, I know the ongoing problem we've had in terms of getting highway dollars to support the state police. In this particular sphere of activity, have we talked anyway about potential of using highway funds, especially if we're talking about protecting ODOT's liabilities?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, we have been very fortunate that ODOT is a partner in this. And so, yes, we do have federal dollars that have been earmarked so that we can conduct this training. In fact, we will be doing some training later this year that the funds are all coming from ODOT with the assistance of some federal highway funds for that. So we are and have.
Captain Hayes as well. I don't know if there's any data as to if you guys measure your response time, how long it takes you to clear the highway, but I think it's relevant to, you don't have to answer that today. I'm sure you don't have that up your sleeve. I wouldn't expect you to, but if your agency can get back with us, or maybe Lieutenant may know.
Mr. Chair, we do have that data, and I can give you some specific crashes as well, and we can provide that for you. I believe I was in the area of crime reduction, and we have two programs there. That's our criminal apprehension through patrol enforcement and then our juvenile crime education. And then I talked about, just got into aircraft patrol, collision reconstruction, the drug recognition, motorcycle, and non-preference tow. We also help address local transportation safety and crime concerns in each region, area command, and worksite through the development and implementation of tactical plans that are directed towards the division programs. And so, in other words, we're working with the locals in some of these areas that are in accordance with the local cooperative policing agreements, and then also from public input. If we have certain areas, certain problem areas, and I can give you an example, back in my days in Albany, well, that was when we actually started the Highway 34 safety corridor. And that was created from a problem that we had and a great deal of public input. So once we get the public together, we review that input, and then we can at times be able to actually go and address a problem area like Highway 34, Highway 18, and some of those other areas, Highway 22 going up towards the pass and areas like that. We do this through education, engineering, and enforcement, and then definitely follow that up with evaluation. We want to go back and be able to tell, have we made an impact? Have we significantly reduced injuries, traffic fatalities in those areas? So we follow that up with evaluation. This is all tied into our performance measures, and I've listed those performance measures there for you as well. But we've got five Oregon benchmarks that these are tied into, and that's number 41 is infant mortality, number 45 premature mortality, number 61 the crime rate, number 62 is juvenile crime, and then number 66, which I talked about, is our cooperative policing and agreements we have there. In the area of crash reduction, those are tied to benchmarks number 41 and 45, and we accomplished this by literally making the state and interstate highways safe. We do that through our high visibility traffic enforcement. We all know that if the trooper is out there and a marked patrol car has seen officially engaged or even setting alongside the highway, well, that is a visibility that does remind motorists that we're out there, and so that does create some enforcement efforts there. Also, impaired driving education enforcement. Impaired driving, as some numbers I'll be giving you here shortly, really there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area, and we're doing a lot in that area. Commercial vehicle enforcement, that's always a concern of ours because we do have an increase of commercial vehicles traveling through our state, and it looks like it's going to continue through the years. So it's imperative that someone is checking those commercial vehicles to ensure that they are safe. I've had a chance to explain to some of you during the interim committee that what we do with Operation Trucker Check, and all of our troopers that are assigned to this division and patrol are certified as truck inspectors and can do a safety inspection at any time, any place, if they feel the need or if they have a vehicle that is in question. In the area of occupant protection and education, we do a lot there. Our efforts have really helped in the state of Oregon. Mr. Costales may have addressed your group talking about where Oregon stands, but we're in the top two or three when it comes to occupant protection use. We're up to about 90%, and a lot of that is through very extensive education and also enforcement. Work zone safety, we pride ourselves in Oregon as well, and because we're in the top of the list there as far as reducing fatalities and injuries that are occurring in work zone safety areas. And I'll be talking about the increase that we're going to be seeing that in that area. When it comes to crash data and what it indicates, the majority of the serious injury crashes and fatalities are basically caused by three things, and that is speeds that are too fast for the conditions, failure to use the occupant protection devices and restraints, and then also driving under the influence of intoxicants. ODOT data that was recently put out showed that during the past four-year period, Oregon has experienced the lowest numbers of traffic fatalities since 1959 to 1962. So our efforts are working. We're doing a good job there. I can tell you in the last 2 years on rural state and interstate highways of the fatalities that we have had in Oregon, about 44% of those are on the rural state and interstate highways. So we have made some reductions in that area. I guess one thing that kind of concerns me, though, and to bring it to your attention, is that immediately after the layoffs of February 1st, we started tracking fatalities on rural state and interstate highways. And for the month of February, that number increased to 57%. So we were averaging about 44 and jumped to 57. And, of course, it's still early, but we're hoping that we can reduce that number and get it further below 44%. On pages 5 and 6 of your handout, I provided two performance measure graphs for you that kind of illustrate Oregon's fatal crash successes and failures. And I can say that if you look at Oregon compared to the nation, again, we're doing a good job, because the graph indicates there that Oregon's fatality rate is 1.3 deaths per 100 million miles traveled, which is below the national rate, which is 1.5. And so, again, we feel that we're doing a good job there. The graph also shows that those fatalities are declining proportionately. The second graph that you have there shows that kind of what we've done through the years, and then also illustrates what we hope to accomplish if we have troopers out working the road and we're taking care of the rural state and interstate highways. And unfortunately, though, that number, there's still a lot of numbers on there. There's a lot of people that are unfortunately dying on those state and rural state and interstate highways. So I hope those two graphs kind of give you an idea and sort of illustrate what we're doing in that area.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. I just wondered if there was a reason for the spike in 1998. Was there something identified for that particular year that caused that, going from 220 up by such a high percentage and then dropping back down below 200 the following year?
Back about, Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, back about that time, Oregon was really, the seatbelt and occupant restraint rates were not nearly as good as they are now. And so we kind of attribute that more than anything to the failure to using of the seat belts, child restraints, and so that was really when we began a real heavy push. And by that dropping down to 194, I think that definitely showed that the emphasis that we put. So I would put more of that just to the seatbelt rate usage back at that time.
Thank you.
The overall decline in highway deaths, so one of the things that our division, the state police, we take very seriously is impaired driving enforcement, and I touched on that earlier. In 2001, our troopers out there arrested 5,389 impaired drivers, which was an increase of what we had seen in some of the years past. But in 2002, just to let you know how dedicated our troopers were and how seriously we took that, we increased that by 1,551, with really not much of an increase in patrol troopers out there. So I think a lot of that is emphasized in the training that we do. That is one of our major programs. We train our officers to, as drug recognition experts, and also how to be able to detect alcohol impairment. And so that increase in DUI arrests, I think, has had a significant impact on saving lives as well. I want to add one other thing. Again, we're kind of comparing to see how we did after February 1st. Well, each week prior to February 1st, our troopers were averaging about 100 DUI arrests a week throughout the state. And that number after the February 1st layoffs has actually dropped down to about 60 to 65 arrests per week. And I do not believe that that's because there are less impaired drivers driving out there. That is obviously just because we just don't have the people to detect them. So they are still out there and still a hazard on our highways. As I mentioned, driving at speeds too fast for the conditions continues to be a problem. We've got 2001 ODOT data that you will see there in your handout that indicates about 36% of all of the fatal crashes statewide are attributed to excessive speed that is too fast for the conditions. Our Oregon State Police Reconstruction Unit, as I touched on earlier, we do a lot of crash analysis. In fact, every one of these that we investigate, our members try to determine what was the causation or the contributing factors. And of those, in 2002, approximately 40% of those fatal crashes involved the speeds that were too fast for the conditions. So it is a continuing problem. We've taken numerous specialized steps and services, resources that we direct towards crash reduction, and I touched on some of these as earlier. That's the collision reconstruction and cause analysis. By reviewing each and every one of these crashes and working with ODOT, well, then we can make recommendations. Maybe we have a particular highway that speeds are too fast, or maybe it's a particular corridor where we need to look at redirecting some enforcement efforts and things like that. So that kind of falls along with our drug recognition training, the standardized field sobriety testing, the commercial vehicle enforcement, and some of those other programs as well. In our reconstruction program, the collision reconstruction program, they work very closely with other agencies. In fact, I'll just give you some quick figures here, including ODOT. But in 2002, our 14 collision reconstructionists and 22 technical collision investigators reviewed 260 crashes, investigated 58 fatal crashes, and provided outside assistance to other agencies that requested our assistance because of the technicality of the crashes themselves in 27 of those investigations. So we do try to assist our local partners whenever we can, because we know that this is kind of a specialized area. In the area of drug evaluation classification, we started that program in Oregon in 1995, and this division is the coordinator and manager of that statewide program. It's a national program. Oregon was the 24th state to get involved in that. And then since 1995, we've trained over 200 police officers that are city, county, and state officers in having them with the ability to detect drug impairment and drug-impaired drivers. And since 1995, it's had an impact because we have we've increased drug-impaired driving arrests by 150%. And this is everything from driving under the influence of methamphetamine to marijuana to cocaine to some of the newer drugs like GHB and ecstasy and those kind of things, and even in prescription drugs. And one area that there's an increase, and we're seeing more of this, and that is the over-the-counter substances that are out there. There's a lot of ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, things that can be purchased at a truck stop that really is just a legalized form of methamphetamine if it's used in a large enough quantity. So we're starting to see those things as well. Last year in 2002, we did the entire state of drug recognition experts did over 1,200 drug evaluations on suspected drug-impaired drivers. And the Oregon State Police officers, we did close to 500 of those 1,280 evaluations. So we're pretty busy in that area.
Captain Haynes, do those have to be evaluated more than just on the highway? Is that a lab evaluation? So,
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That is a post-arrest evaluation that is really technical in nature, and so it's something that is done down at a jail or the booking facility.
And will our rural labs continue to be able to do that where we do have rural labs?
Mr. Chair, it is something that the urine is forwarded to our labs, and yes, they will continue to do that. They're triaging that urine that comes in now, and so what we're trying to do is prioritize that. So as an example, you have a couple of drug recognition experts in Ontario, at Ontario PD. So if Officer Bakken was to do an evaluation, he would send that urine to the lab, and then based upon the input from the crime lab as to whether or not they were going to go ahead and prosecute that, then they would triage that to determine when that would be that toxicology would be conducted.
But the forensic lab in Ontario, let's see, that's Steve Termino. He's able to do that, though.
No, sir. Mr. Chair, he would forward that to either our Springfield lab or Portland lab, because that's where we have the specialized instruments to do that.
Senator George is recognized, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have the authority, like the port of entry, to require a commercial driver to do a urine analysis? The reason I asked that question, I had a truck down to California, and I had a mediocre sleeper on it, so I was kind of sitting there in the sleeper looking out the window, and I didn't want to get back on the road the next morning because of drug transactions I saw going on that parking lot. The first thought I had was, we had to just do a sting type thing where we pop everybody coming through on a given day, because I was absolutely in shock as to how many drivers. I mean, that parking lot was filled with trucks, and I don't think there was anybody there except for me that wasn't buying drugs. Do we have the authority then to... It's now your time.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, we have the authority if we can determine that there's a possibility of drug impairment there. We have to have some sort of reasonable suspicion. Now, DOT, if they were on site, they could do that. They have the authority to do that. We look at it as reasonable suspicion or probable cause in that area. And what you've talked about, I wholeheartedly agree, because that falls into Operation Trucker Check, which Representative Hansen was interested in during the interim. And we do those surprise 48-hour inspections at different ports of entry or truck stops and those locations. And believe it or not, the Oregon Trucking Association wholeheartedly supports this. So we are in partnership with them, and it's something that it is needed, because what you're talking about, the drug transactions and over-the-counter substances, yes, those are something that unfortunately are involved in the commercial vehicle industry too much.
Captain Hayes, I thought that I was surprised at your comment that you couldn't do it, but DOT could. I thought that you were deputized over the top of DOT.
Mr. Chair, we can, but again, it all gets back to a driving violation, so suspected of DUI or something like that.
But
so
DOT doesn't have to have the same level of suspicion?
I would have to check on that to be sure, Mr. Chair, but they... when they do their inspections, they can actually request that. And when we do an Operation Trucker Check, we do it in partnership with DOT and ODOT so that we can ensure that that does happen.
Well, again, I thought that you assumed that you were one level higher and had that responsibility and authority as well. Senator George?
Believe me, I think somebody must have the authority, because back when I was maintaining that CDL for over-the-road use, when they tell you to get in there and pee in that cup, they're doggone serious about it, and you better be there in a certain amount of time. So somebody has the authority to tell you to go do that. Now, my thought was, can you amplify that one more degree and actually catch them out on the road? Because there is plenty of time in order to take appropriate steps if you were so inclined. But if you were literally setting up an operation to say, everybody coming in here, here it is, go do it.
Excellent. Representative Hansen's recognized.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no question that there's a lot of illegal activity that goes on, but I think we've got to be a little bit careful in terms of, like, even even on the work that you did at Woodburn, with, I forget the name of the operation now.
Operation Trucker Check.
Trucker Check. Mm-hmm. Where you checked a huge number of trucks over a weekend. That was still only an incredibly small percentage of the trucks that are on the road. And when we talk about, you know, truck drivers, mm-hmm. there's an awful lot of truck drivers. The vast, vast majority of them don't use drugs, are concerned about their equipment, are pretty decent citizens. And sometimes we can get a little carried away in terms of when we talk about the problem that we reflect on every guy driving a 18-wheeler, and that's just not the case. But where it is a problem, but I think in terms of making every honest truck driver that enters the state have a urine test, that's probably a little bit of overkill.
Mr. Chairman, I probably had to answer that, and I wasn't suggesting we do that on a day-to-day basis. But there's no question that there is a change within behavior based upon the fact of enforcement and testing. And so, and that was my point, is the appropriate balance to make sure that we do have safe drivers. There's nothing worse than a person with an 80 or 105,000-pound truck who may, in fact, not be totally faculted up.
Thank you, Mr. digress on a personal debate, but sure. The legitimate trucking companies and the vast sure. majority of the trucking companies are already testing their employees on a random basis, so they're I don't think they're the problem, and it's trying to identify which is the segment of the industry that is the problem, and that there may be some serious consequences in down the road that percentage may even get bigger.
Sounds to me like if they had done a sting operation on that truck, the truck stopped, they'd have shut her down.
Oh, man, I tell you, I almost died. If I had my cell phone, I would have actually called police.
Now, Representative Patridge is the chair, and he's taking the gavel with him. So I knew it was getting tough with the co-chairs back in the back room back there. Well, I didn't think it was getting... Doug, do you want to give us an update of who's when?
I think the co-chairs would be best to...
Okay.
To point that out, or Representative Crawford.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, sir. One other area is in our commercial vehicle enforcement, which kind of ties into the questions and the comments. But in 2001, as I said, our troopers are trained as truck inspectors. We inspected 13,382 commercial vehicles statewide. And during that same period of time, I think this is significant, is that we also saw a decrease of 102 commercial vehicle crashes in the state. Last year, 2002, we actually upped that. We increased those numbers to 15,909. I wish I was able today to provide you with what sort of impact we've had on commercial vehicle crashes, but that data has just not been collected yet. And we are hoping that we would see even a better impact than what we had in 2001 with those 102 crashes. I also mentioned a number of our troopers are specially trained in occupant protection, child safety seats. We work very closely with ODOT to provide education and aggressive enforcement. Last year, 2002, about 30% of all of the enforcement activities for the state was accomplished by our division members. So it is something, again, that we take very seriously in ensuring that people are complying with the occupant protection statutes. Highway work zone safety, we work very closely with ODOT. And as I said, Oregon is one of the best in the nation. In 2001, there were 6 deaths that occurred within highway work zone construction areas. 2002, we reduced that down to 5. We've made significant work in that area from the 1990s when we were seeing almost double that in the work zones. Our troopers are assigned to work in these work zones when we have personnel available to do that. In fact, in 2001, we devoted over 8,000 hours to working in the construction zones, issuing over 1,000 citations. The division also has two specialized support programs that assist in addressing the transportation safety needs and problem areas, and one of those is our motorcycle program, which provides a specialized service to the support and enhancement of crash reduction and also assists with other transportation safety services. In 2002, our motors provided support and enforcement on 12 major events in the state, which included the Seaside Spring Break, which is always a very active time, and the motors are very beneficial working that, and then also one presidential visit. Our motors in 2002 accounted for 8,554 citations, working mostly in those problem crash areas and supporting local tactical plans. We use them quite frequently in problem areas like the Highway 18 corridor and those traffic safety corridors because of the fact that they're a little more mobile and can get through traffic and work through traffic, so very beneficial in that regard. The second is our aircraft enforcement program, and this is a program where we provide specialized assistance for enforcement of high-speed and aggressive driving on the state and interstate highways. In the past 2 years, we've utilized our aircraft, the patrol aircraft, 113 times for enforcement flights on state and interstate highways. We accounted for 2,332 traffic citations and 286 hours of operation, which equates to 8.2 citations per hour. So it's effective. It's an effective tool when we're able to use that. One example that I like to relate to is on Interstate 5 between Portland and Salem in the Woodburn area. We used it during a 1.5-hour operation up there, and it was on a Sunday. And during that 1.5-hour time, we used the aircraft, and we wrote 34 citations, and five of those were for speeds over 100 miles an hour. And one of those was for a speeder that was traveling 116 miles an hour. And those type of speeders, the aircraft is just a tremendous tool in finding those people and enforcing the speed laws and aggressive driving. We also have two division programs that I mentioned earlier about that assist us in reducing crime, and that would be our criminal apprehension through patrol and then our juvenile crime. These are related to and linked to benchmarks number 61 and 62 that help us reduce crime through education, traffic contacts, and patrol enforcement. Our troopers respond to and investigate crimes. It's not just issuing traffic citations. They make arrests on warrants and probable cause. We clear the highway of abandoned autos. We assist motorists in need. We provide medical assistance. And then when we have the resources that allow us to, we assist in school and community drug presentations whenever possible. We don't do that nearly as much, obviously, but just because we don't have the resources to do that. The area of criminal apprehension through patrol, data for the past 2 years has been very favorable, showing that our troopers do an excellent job in detecting crime and through criminal apprehension. Last year, our patrol members made over 9,000 criminal arrests. They served over 5,000 arrest warrants. They made over 3,000 drug arrests and were involved in over 1,500 drug investigations on the rural, state, and interstate highways. I've also provided you with... I'm sorry.
On the 4,000 arrest warrants, why were state police serving them instead of like county sheriff's offices or local officials?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, these would be from traffic stops. So if a trooper or just during any type of a contact, it could be a disabled motorist, it could be a medical assist, where we are actually running checks on them, and then person is wanted, then we go ahead and serve the warrant. Page 11 on your handout, I also have another graph that kind of shows what we are doing in the crime reduction and our performance measure strategies. And again, patrol troopers routinely are dispatched to reports of crime or detect crime through unreported contacts or crime and through a variety of contacts, actually. And the graph illustrates that what we're doing in this area. 2001 division members, we investigated 7,733 crimes. And during that time, we also made 6,860 arrests, which if you looking at the arrests in comparison with the crimes, well, we have a clearance rate of approximately 89%. Which I think is outstanding. In the area of juvenile crime prevention and enforcement, juvenile crime is a concern for us all, and we just see that this continues to escalate, as many law enforcement agencies do, so it's a concern to us. In 2001 and 2002, our patrol troopers issued over 2,000 citations, criminal citations, to juveniles for a variety of crimes, and also issued over 3,000 for alcohol-related citations to juveniles. And as I said, when we are allowed to, and when resources allow us to do this, we're involved in some localized prevention efforts whenever possible. There are a number of factors, I guess, that affect our services that I've talked about, and I'll go through those real quickly here. One is the administrative overhead costs for my position, the lieutenant, and other staff within the division, which equates to about 3.28% of our division budget. But other factors include the increases in traffic volume and the motorists that are using the rural and state and interstate highways. I've given you some figures there of what's happened to us in the past 20 years, and you may have seen these or heard these already. But Oregon, in the past 20 years, we've seen an approximately 35% increase in licensed drivers. We also have about a 45% increase in registered vehicles. We did some crunching of some data to determine where we rate as far as a trooper per registered vehicle. And Oregon has approximately 11,285 registered vehicles for every one trooper, which is the second highest ratio in the country. When we look at that in also regarding population, because we've had about a 25% population increase, and look at what we have for residents, Oregon has approximately 10,887 residents for every one trooper, which is also second highest in the country. These factors, and obviously the factor that looms as one of the largest out there, and that's the what I feel is a huge impact with this agency, is the continual decline in patrol troopers statewide, really does affect how we do our business and what we can do. And I will be bringing a couple of troopers with the chair's permission up to talk about that here shortly. With the decline in our staff and what we've gone through as far as budgetary reductions, the division continues to take steps, though, to try to reduce some of our expenditures and reduce program costs. They include extending the life and age out of our patrol vehicles. Those are being ran out now to about 120,000 miles, and if we can get a little longer out of them, we will, if it's safe to do that. We're extending the life and age out of our patrol motorcycles. We reuse equipment, so if one vehicle is aged out, well, we take the light bar and the cage and all of that equipment out of that car and reuse that for as long as we can. We're also continuing to acquire federal grants, as Representative Hansen discussed, about getting money from ODOT in some of these areas, so there are federal grants that are available, so we're trying to, whenever we can, procure those grants whenever possible. And then also when it comes to training, we try to conduct as much of our in-house training as we can so that we can avoid the costs of sending people out of state or bringing out of state instructors in. And we do feel very comfortable, and we pride ourselves here and with the department that we have some of the best instructors in the country. In fact, our instructors are asked to go out of state many times, but we do our own in-house training to try to avoid those additional costs. At this time, I'd like to defer to Mr. McGee, if I could, and who will discuss policy option packages and the governor's recommended budget, if that's all right.
Chair, thank you, Bill McGee, for the gas. I'll give him my hand out here in a second. Okay, on page two again, the numbers. The budget for the patrol division, governor's budget, is $74 million general fund, $81.2 million total funds. That's a 0.4% decrease from the closing session budget for general fund and a 2.7% decrease in total funds. The patrol division is primarily a general funded program. About 91% of the funding for this division is general fund, 9% other, and 0% federal. The budget, I said, is about a 9%, 9/10% decrease from the close of, from the fifth special session budget. The major changes approved by the special sessions were the cancellation of the January 2003 recruit school and the elimination of 101 troopers, three special unit supervisors, and a research position.
Could you pull that mic over closer?
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Thank you. Again, the major changes in the special sessions were the cancellation of the recruit school, the elimination of 101 troopers, three special unit supervisors, and a research position in House Bill 5100, and the 75% funding for the compensation increases. The governor's budget, as you know, restored 40 sworn troopers, and it shifted funding on sworn positions that had been expired by a federal grant to be able to continue 11 of 20 positions that had been supported by the federal grant. And Senate Bill 5548, this session restored 40 troopers for the remainder of this biennium with no roll-up for next because the positions were already in the governor's budget. Much like the department, overall, the funding for this division is primarily personal services, 77%, with a 19% for services and supplies and about 4% for capital outlay. The total funds budget is pretty similar. It's still primarily a personal services budget in this division. Okay. Taking you through the development of the budget, starting with the $74.4 million general fund at the close of session, the $84 million total funds. No emergency board actions through April affecting this division. The second special session reduced the budget by about $1.8 million in general fund. Again, that's the recruit school cancellation, the elimination of disabled parking program, and various vacancies and reduction in temporary assignments. The base budget adjustments, primarily the roll-up in the personal services costs from 103 to 0305, increasing the general fund by about $2.1 million, eliminating a position. The step increases estimated at $1.2 million general fund, $1.4 million total funds. Going through the essential packages, the package 010 is about a $900,000 general fund increase, about a million total funds. Package 20, the phase-in, phase-outs, they primarily were the phase-out of the second special session reductions and elimination of former contracted type of incentive pay that is no longer being granted to new officers. Package 30, inflation, state government service charges. Inflation was $253,000 general, $283,000 total. And the state government service charges, $6.5 million general fund, $6.6 million total fund. Primarily here is the tort liability assessment, which is primarily ascribed to the patrol division because that's where the case drove that came from. Technical adjustments, this division, the transfer of the special weapons and tactics of SWAT and the mobile response team supervision from human services to human resources rather to patrol services for administrative purposes. The only revenue reduction in package 70 was a small amount of other funds. Oregon State University has eliminated one sworn officer in their security unit. They contract with state police. That officer will not be restored. Reduction in service at OSU. Package 81, third special session, just the reduction of the elimination of the cost of living increases for salary range 38 and above. The specified portion in package 82 of the fifth special session reductions was just holding some vacancies and reducing services and supplies for about $175,000 reduction. The package 83, the October 2002 emergency board, increased the budget for this division by $1.6 million general fund. Primarily the rebalance included reductions in overtime salary differentials to increase the funding for vehicle purchases, vehicle operations, and other services and supplies. Package 91, the fifth special session, unspecified reductions. Again, these were the elimination of the 101 troopers, the three special unit supervisors in the research position. And package 92 restored 40 of those troopers, $5.5 million against the $14.4 million reduction. Now, getting into the policy packages, which were not specifically discussed in the agency summary, package 100, a base adjustment package, reduces federal funds by $1.2 million. That eliminated 9 sworn positions after a federal COPS grant that had been supporting those positions finally expired. Originally, there were 20 officers that were supported by the federal COPS grant. We were able to save 11 of those essentially by shifting the funding from the other 9. So we saved 11 by eliminating 9 and replacing the federal dollars. Package 101 is a reorganization issue. We raised this as a potential policy concern, so you are aware of it. $1.3 million reduction in general fund. It shifted the funding and positions for the Capitol Mall, the Legislative Security and Dignitary Protection units to the Criminal Investigations Division, where they will be under the Office of Public Safety and Security, out of the Patrol Division. And Package 104 reduced the budget by $1 and eliminated 4 positions. That simply shifted the dollars that were in personal services to overtime for truck enforcement, which is where those dollars are traditionally spent anyway, so the positions were not necessary.
Can we back up to 101, and that is the legislative security issue? Is it possible to bring in private patrol or other type of officers in order to guard the Capitol, or is there something statutory that requires that it be state police?
That the department.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Danny Bisgard, budget director for the department. Certainly has a history. Used to have DAS providing that security, and then the policy makers were that we would provide the security. If I may, we've prepared a handout, which we'll get to in the very near future, of the pluses and minuses on privatizing that type of security. And if we could defer to that, we'll get that information to you, Senator.
Appreciate you having you here, but you know, when money is short, I keep thinking I'd rather have patrol, investigation, and all those other things going on. We can do that. Okay, thanks.
Just to finish up quickly, there are no fee or revenue change issues here for this division. The technical adjustments, about a $12,000, $13,000 increase in general fund and a $744,000 reduction in other funds. The other funds issue is we just had excess other funds limitations for Department of Transportation grants and contracts, and with no revenue support, that will just eliminate the expenditure limitation. And the rest is just adjusting personal services estimates that we use during budget preparations to what the real dollars were once we loaded the positions into the system.
All right, apparently so
that would be my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. As previously mentioned, we've experienced some reductions, and what this has done is weakened our ability to uphold some of our public safety responsibilities in many areas of the state. So with the Chair's permission, I'd like to bring up Sergeant Scott Lorimore, who is from our Newport office, who is going to give us just a couple of examples of what is going on the Central Oregon coast.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Well,
my name is Scott Lorimore. I'm out of the Newport Area Command. And I'm currently supervising Florence office. Just give you a little bit of background of the area that the Newport Area Command involves. It's approximately 160 miles of Oregon coastline, including all the state highways, ocean beaches, and highways inland, approximately 30 to 50 miles. There are approximately between 75 and 100 state parks and waysides in this area that I'm currently assigned to. We've got a cooperative policing agreement which requires us to basically patrol and basically take care of all the state highways, ocean beaches, and interstate, or actually federal highways, which is U.S. 101. Prior to the reduction on February 1st, we had 22 troopers assigned to that 160 miles, patrol troopers. After the reduction, we lost 16 for those 3 offices that we are out of, that basically Newport Area Command is in charge of, which would be Florence, Newport, and Tillamook. When we got the 40 positions back out of those 3 offices, we obtained 2 back. We've had to reduce our patrol coverage from anywhere from, well, in one office, in the Newport office example, would have been 18 hours down to 8 hours a day shift only. And in the Florence office, it's down to about 10 hours a day. There have been a couple instances that have occurred during this layoff period. I'd like to mention one. It was a fatal crash. It occurred on Highway 18. This would have been the same morning or the day that my troopers in Newport were turning in their equipment. It was a young man that left work from Lincoln City that night, proceeded on his way home to Salem, and he never arrived in Salem. On Saturday, it would have been the 1st of February, his family reported him missing to Lincoln City Police Department because that was where he was working. On the 3rd of February, Lincoln City Police Department asked the Sheriff's Office to do a search and rescue because that's what they do, and that young man who was 19 years old was located about a minute before the family members located him because the family members were also out on Highway 18 looking for that young man. I know, have talking to my, and knowing that my troopers that were laid off would have been on that highway that day, the 31st, and also working that night when the young man left his place of employment. I've got a trooper that lives less than a mile away from where he works, and he would have been right in that area working. So he basically, my troopers work that area very hard. I've got two of them that work that area, and they are very familiar with that road and where that crash occurred. Fortunately, in this case, for the family, the young man died instantly in this crash. So that was that one incident. One more incident I'd like to bring up after this, about a week after the layoffs occurred, where a young lady near Cape Perpetua, which is south of Yahats, her vehicle was found by a park ranger off the cliff, and apparently she had left the roadway and ended up over the embankment, and she was in her vehicle from approximately 7:30 that evening until actually about 6 o'clock that evening until 7:30 the next morning, and the park ranger found her. She did survive that crash. My trooper that worked that area was also laid off. He would have located this crash because he patrols that area very heavily down there. And it would have been a very easily crash to see, but there was no patrols at that time in the day. That's just a couple of incidences I've had in my area over there in 101 and Highway 18. Basically, my patrols over there right now are going call to call. They're unable to patrol actively and enforce a lot of the traffic laws and that we were doing before. So basically are running call to call, taking care of calls for us right now. I just want to close with a little personal note that I live and work in Lincoln County, and I, driving my own personal vehicle after hours in the evenings, have found that speeds have gotten up quite a bit, and that I've pretty much decided that my family will not travel at nighttime in this area.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
The reduction from 22 to 16, obviously that wasn't proportional in terms of the proportion of the life, of the percentage of the total troopers. Why was your office hit so much harder or so disproportionately?
All right, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, actually we were reduced down to 6, minus 16.
No, you lost 16.
Yes.
16 out of 22, which is 75% decrease. Why was your office hit that hard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm sorry. Due to the fact that most of my troopers on the coast are young and new hires, then
they haven't. The manpower isn't being redistributed. Or, if you've got a young workforce in one part of the state, those positions just stay empty, or is there going to be a redistribution at some point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I couldn't answer that question. I just know that the workforce of my troopers that are assigned to the coast are the younger troops on the department, so that's how they were recalled, the tenure on the department.
Will there be a redistribution, or are we going to leave a certain areas just based on that being disproportionately? Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that is something that is policy-wise this agency is taking a look at. And yes, we are taking a look at if there is a need for redistribution based upon the personnel that we have. And those are some concerns we have because, as the sergeant indicated, there are very few troopers on Highway 101 from Astoria to Gold Beach. So, yes, those are concerns that we have to deal with, and we will be addressing those.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, it doesn't surprise me because, I think everybody here understands why it occurs in this way and probably understands, most collective bargaining agreements, you're going to lay off on the basis of seniority. And you're also going to get assignments on the basis of seniority. And if your younger troopers go to a certain area, they're going to be the first to lay it off. And then, of course, it presents an enormous difficulty to families if you're required to relocate. Maybe you were in Central Oregon, and now they want you to relocate to the coast. And I don't know what the agreements are there. But it does seem to be like something that, I don't know, you'd have to find a timely way to address, because you wouldn't want to go like this for even 3 months or 6 months or a year. Just a comment. I think we all understand why it happened, but
thanks, Sergeant.
Thank you, Sergeant.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I have one other trooper, and then we should be wrapping this up. But
do you have any, Cap, do you have any troopers that came from out of area that we need to get to?
Mr. Chair, I do, and that's Trooper Pierce from Astoria.
Okay, is he the only one?
He is.
Okay, I'm willing to stay longer if you have other troopers from that area.
Trooper Pierce will come forward.
On the road.
I asked him to come today just to give you an example, because as other resources kind of dwindle in other parts of the area, it also puts added emphasis on the things that we do and don't do, so I've asked Trooper Pierce to come today to give an example of that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jim Pierce. I'm out of the Astoria Patrol Office, Astoria Area Command. My assignment with the state police is as a collision reconstructionist. I'm assigned to the patrol division as a collision reconstructionist, and in technicalities, I'm responsible for 13 counties in our northwest region to assure that the investigations are done correctly in each of those cases. What I'd like to present here today is that out of the Astoria office, we lost five people out of the layoffs. With that loss of five people, we were originally covering nearly 24 hours of coverage a day. We're now down to approximately 16 hours of coverage per day with the amount of staff that we have. Also, with the lessening of the patrol troopers that we do have, we're also seeing an increase in the speed and increase in other traffic issues that are taking place. As you may or may not be aware, we are a major thoroughfare from the Portland area to the seaside or the coastal area, so we do get a lot of heavy traffic along that section as well. One incident that I would like to refer to that we also get involved in, is that while I'm one day here, just shortly after the layoff time period, I was in the office starting on my paperwork when we had a gentleman come to the desk or to the front office and reported to us a person that was attempting to commit suicide on the Megler Bridge, and this is a bridge that crosses over from Oregon to Washington. It's a 4-mile-long bridge, and it gets very high right up near on the Oregon side where the ships travel under the bridge. Because of the lack of patrols that we had, I happened to be the only one in the office, and as it was, luckily, I happened to be in the office and went outside and observed this subject trying to climb over the side of the bridge. I went up there and took the subject off the bridge, just stopped him literally within seconds before he jumped over the side of the bridge, got him off the bridge. We got him down to the hospital for a checkup, a mental evaluation checkup. At that point, the subject ended up ultimately being released back on his own into the community within a couple hours earlier because he was deemed to be found not an imminent threat to himself. It's these type of situations. This same person, 2 days prior to this incident, and I believe this incident occurred on the 14th of February, so this is after the layoffs occurred. 2 days prior to this incident, this same subject had also been found on the beach in Seaside by some Seaside police officers that had been called in down there as attempting to commit suicide with a gun. He had a gun to his head. The gun was loaded with a round in the chamber. And at that time, again, he was found and deemed, at least by members not from our department, by other agencies, to apparently be not an imminent threat to his own welfare and safety. It's because of these things we have an increasing number of these things that we're seeing and less people on the road or out on our streets to handle. So we are handling other things other than traffic issues such as writing citations and so forth. And then one other area that I would like to also just address the committee on, and I believe Captain Hayes already talked about that, and that's the issue of a drug and or alcohol impairment and the fatalities that are taking place with that. As Captain Hayes did mention, that we are seeing an increase, or one of the major issues of our fatal collisions is speed. Another area of that is also alcohol and drug impairment. On the 13th of February, just outside the Astoria area on Rural State Highway, we had a fatality collision in which a 73-year-old female was killed as a gentleman crossed over the center lane and struck her vehicle head-on. The gentleman had just turned 21 years of age within the month. In fact, he turned 21 in January. At the time of the collision, his blood alcohol level was at a 0.28. He was also found by the toxicology to be on having marijuana in his system and to be on prescription medications, mainly Vicodin or hydrocodone, which is Vicodin. Because of that, we are seeing also an increase in our fatalities where there are alcohol and drug impairment issues going on. Prior to the layoff time period, as Captain Hayes mentioned, we were having our office would be arresting sometimes 10 to 20 DUIs per month. We are arresting very few now out of our office just because we don't have the manpower available to do that anymore.
Thank you for making the trip up from the coast. I certainly appreciate you sharing your information. Any other questions by the committee? Thank you, Captain. Is this a logical stopping point?
I have about 5 minutes, and I can be actually completed, so it's
okay.
Your choosing.
Sure. Is the committee okay to stay for 5 minutes? Thank you, Captain.
I just wanted to kind of bring those troopers up to give you some sort of an idea as to what is going on as far as the lack and the ability not to handle some of the calls for service and those responsibilities that we have. We know that the reduction of the 102 positions I've listed for you in your handout, what that is going to equate to for as far as calls for service and citations, arrests, and those kind of things. With the restoration of the 40 positions that we have that you've given us last week, I've also indicated what that will equate to, and this is using actual factual numbers from what our troopers do out in the field. So I've listed those totals there for you. I have an example of that I also wanted to give you real quickly, and this is in the St. Helens work site. Two of the troopers that were restored went back to St. Helens. And 2 days after they were restored and put back out on patrol, which they were more than happy to come back and take their jobs, there was a burglary in progress report that was reported up in the Rainier area near the bridge that goes into Washington. The two troopers responded. One of the troopers, Trooper Hazenkamp, responded and actually stopped the vehicle that was coming from that area and ended up arresting that person for burglary. He had in his possession six weapons and a TV set and some other things that were taken from that residential burglary. Two other people that were suspects actually fled on foot and were headed for the bridge going into Washington. Going into Washington, state of Washington,
And Trooper Moyer, who had been just put back out on patrol, was actually able to apprehend those people as they were fleeing on foot. And they had also in their possession guns and merchandise and things, property that was taken from that residential burglary. So it just kind of shows you that just 2 days after being put out on patrol, what kind of an impact they can have. And it's not always just issuing traffic citations, but in a situation like this where local law enforcement could not take care of it, and it was in an area that really was not a state highway or an interstate highway, but we intervened and were able to actually apprehend the suspects. Also, I've listed in your handout our proposed legislation, House Bill 2176, which has passed through the House and through the Senate, deals with a new statute, failure to maintain a safe distance from an emergency vehicle or an ambulance. We thank you for hearing that and passing that on, because we do feel that that is a tremendous safety tool for safeguarding our people and emergency response people that are on the highway. The budget note, you have heard by our legislative fiscal officer, so that has been taken care of. And really, that concludes my presentation. Unless you have questions of me, I thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and to get the division taken care of today. And those questions that you have brought up, we will get you answers and have those delivered to you.
Thank you, Captain. Questions of the Captain? Thank you, Danny, and guests today. We certainly appreciate it. We will convene tomorrow at 1 o'clock at the request of the co-chair. That meeting could get canceled, but we will inform you if that happens. At this point, we are adjourned.